Hello, and welcome to episode 3 of Brighton Tales, the podcast that talks to the unsung heroes of Brighton and Hove. I'm your host, Mark Packham. Now, about 8 or so years ago, I used to live in this really big old house at the top of Albion Hill, and I used to live with this excellent bass player called Graham. And one night, Graham came home, and he said that he'd just joined this band called the Bobby McGees. He explained that they played ukuleles and had short, snappy little songs about love, swearing, and wearing out your favourite jeans. Soon after, the band began rehearsing in our living room, and I got to know and love their music. Now, fast forward 8-ish years, and Jimmy and Eleanor are about to release another Bobby McGee's album, and have opened a lovely little shop called Dig for Victory, selling clothing made from vintage fabric. I went down there for a cup of tea and a chat about ukuleles, fascist open mic nights, and the appeal of vintage clothing. If you enjoy this episode, or think you might know someone that I should be talking to in a future episode, get in touch at brightontales.co.uk or at Brighton Tales on Twitter. This is Brighton Tales Episode 3 with the Bobby McGees.
Well, I moved down here to go to university.
Okay.
And then I convinced Jimmy to come with me about a year later.
You said,
so I had one lonely year.
If you don't come down, you'd dump me.
Yeah.
I think I was the, well, we met up in Leicester where Eleanor grew up, and I was working up there. And then after a year of coming down to Brighton, it was kind of like, well, Leicester's a nice place, Leicester's an interesting place, but, you know, there's very few places like Brighton.
Sure.
You know, yeah. Are you from Brighton originally?
Just up the road, about 10 minutes out, so, yeah, in Hassocks, which is kind of middle of nowhere, commuter town. Yeah, I've been here for a while.
Because you often, we were just thinking about it as well, you often wonder, people that grew up in Brighton, you know, what do they do, you know?
And they must see it differently from how we see it.
Yeah.
For us, it's like, oh, this exciting place that we've moved to.
Definitely. I think they probably take it a bit more for granted, the fact that there is, you know, loads of stuff to do. And, whereas us out-towners are still, even after 10 years of being here, you know, still find it novel, you know. So what about the band? Were you doing band stuff before you moved down here?
Yeah, we started up in Leicester.
We played
for maybe a year or so, and we'd started playing gigs in London and that, and I think we still played guitars. Oh, of course we did. We still played guitars then, and then when Eleanor was down here, she went to see the band Herman June and talked about these little funny guitars that they had. And I went, for Valentine's Day, I went to buy her a harmonica. Yeah, a mouth organ. I went to buy you a mouth organ. And I didn't realise how expensive it was.
Not a mandolin you were going to get me?
No, it was a mouth organ. And the guy in the music shop who kind of knew me said, oh, why don't you get one of these and give me a ukulele? And I brought it down. I was a school teacher at the time, and I had Easter holidays or something. No, it was midterm, February. It was Valentine's Day. Gave you ukulele.
It was like, we still have it. It's a little yellow one.
Yeah.
I think it was like £15 or something.
A little novelty.
And I played that. First thing I worked out on it was Anarchy in the UK. You know, and I thought, whoa, and it was so easy to play on it. And then King of the Swingers for the Jungle Book on it. And I just thought, oh, this is like, you know, this is amazing. And I went back to Leicester and bought myself one. Then we found a banjo.
Now Jimmy has about 9 ukuleles,
yeah,
I think.
At least.
Wow. So, arriving in Brighton, you switched to ukuleles by that point?
I think maybe just after we got here.
Okay. Yeah. Was there much of that sort of thing going on when you got into Brighton? Kind of anti-folk?
Well, there was anti-folk, but there wasn't much ukuleles. Mm-hmm. Like, generally, people wouldn't have heard of... You people my age wouldn't have heard of ukulele.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be all, you know, what's that, small guitar, kind of. Whereas then, a few years later, they became huge and...
How were you guys involved in that? Like,
I set up a open mic called the Ukulele Research and Development Society, which is TURDS if you take the first letters, and we ran that for a few years, and that was a good.
We ran it for a couple of years at first, and we'd we'd always encourage people to play different instruments and to play ukuleles, and we'd always end up getting loads of like guys with guitars, you know, still coming down. And then I think we were too busy and we didn't do it for a couple of years, and then we started it again maybe three years ago. And we were just inundated with ukulele players, like whole hordes of them, and they'd come in play in big groups and sit around. And
what caused that shift, do you think? Why has everyone suddenly started picking up ukuleles?
It was our songs.
I'd like to think it was our influence, but I think it was like the ukulele orchestra of Great Britain. I think they became, I don't know if they became famous because the ukulele got popular, or if the ukulele got popular because they became famous.
Did you know that we were banned from playing with them?
tell me the story.
We had a gig in a, what's it called, the Dome, the theatre, sold out gig, with the, you know, back opening up for the ukulele orchestra of Great Britain, and I was interviewed about it. Source did a page thing on it, and then the BBC interviewed me about it, and they said, oh, you must be really happy to be playing with the ukulele orchestra. And I said, well, no, they're just a cheesy covers band, you know. And it's,
you didn't even say it quite like that. You said like, oh yes, I am excited to play with them, but they do just play covers. Or you did say cheesy covers, but you were like relatively restrained.
And then I sit there to think, see, the open mic that we ran was described to me as a semi-fascist open mic, simply because I had a set of rules which weren't semi-fascist rules. They were rules to encourage people. You weren't allowed to play covers at our open mic, and you weren't, you had to, what was it, what was the rules?
Didgeridoo don't
was a good one. Don't sing with your eyes closed.
Don't use the word baby in any of your songs,
unless you're Diana Ross. Oh, the good one, something you got to watch out for. Don't say thank you until someone actually claps, which is good. And if people, there's loads of those, don't blame the audience. Don't
sing about drugs.
Don't sing about drugs, right? Yeah. Not when you're like, don't drink, sing about drugs or booze. You don't have the blues, what you have is a really expensive guitar your dad bought, you know. You know, get off my stage. And then, anyway, in the ukulele orchestra saw their interview and refused to have us.
On the morning of the gig, we'd been practicing, and
we practiced never. We never rehearsed. We never practiced. We'd actually practiced. It's like 1,000 people.
Who did they get instead?
They didn't. The guy that put the gig on, asked if we would play in the foyer. No, we didn't play in the foyer. No.
Let's talk about transitioning from doing band stuff to this the shop, wonderful shop that we're sitting in right now. Tell me about the shop.
The shop we've only had for 6 months, but I've been making dresses for about probably 7 or 8 years now, and I first started making costumes for us to wear on stage, so quite like theatrical sort of stuff. And then I'd find that after gigs, girls would come up to me and ask me where I got my dresses from, rather than buying CDs, which is what we wanted them to.
You probably I assume you make more money out of a dress than you out of a CD, so I wouldn't be complaining.
Well, at the time I was like studying and wasn't, you know, was just doing it as a hobby, but I did quickly cotton on that I actually could probably make some money out of this. And yes, I started collecting vintage fabric and selling on the internet at first, and then it's just been like very gradually sort of grown in getting more and more orders until I couldn't make them all myself, which is when I wrote Jimmy in to help me.
Do either of you have a background in this, or is it just something that you work on and learning as you're going?
Just learnt it as we went along. Like, I studied philosophy, which is not particularly helpful for dressmaking. It was really
I had
actually, you have more of a background in a way.
I've got a degree in home economics, which was food and textiles, and I was a cookery teacher for years and occasionally taught a bit of textiles, but I never really did it to a high level. But both my mother and my grandmother had been tailoresses, and it was funny, at the time when business was kicking off for Eleanor, I was still training as a carpenter and just moaning all the time that I couldn't find work, and moaning that my dad had never taught me any carpentry skills,
and that you were studying with lots of like 17-year-old guys that just were picking up really quickly and just naturally really good, and it sort of finding it a bit hard.
She told me to, she's told me to stop moaning and unpick a zip that she'd been a mistake with one day, and she flung at me and I just unpicked it and sewed it back in, and it was like, oh yeah, I can sew, right? And now we're multi-millionaires with a worldwide empire.
Quite.
So all the dresses are started from scratch, are they? Or
yes.
You, okay.
Yeah. I collect vintage fabric. There's like a couple of guys that are collectors that I buy the fabric from.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a room at the back which is just like full fabric, mm-hmm. which is cool. I used to, when I first started out, I was just doing it like in my bedroom. Well, in our bedroom. Mm-hmm. Which was in a student shared house, and I used to buy like old curtains and things in charity shops, and I used to have to sneak them past Jimmy because I just had too much fabric, and then kind of cram them into like corners and under the bed and behind things so that you couldn't see how much I was buying.
Bed was just balanced on piles.
Yeah, boxes and boxes of fabric with the mattress on.
Sofa made out of it. Yeah.
So now it's very exciting to actually have a whole room that's just fabric.
And do you find that having the shop, has traffic been fairly good? Have people been coming in and browsing?
Yeah, it's been really good for people. We do quite a lot of bridesmaids dresses, and for people, that have seen us on the web online, that they aren't really comfortable ordering something online, because it's not like really cheap. So having it as a place where people can come and try stuff on, it's been like on Saturdays, tend to get really busy with lots of like appointments. And then we don't get a lot of people, just like passing trade, but we actually get a little bit more than I was expecting. So,
yeah, sure.
And I think we'll probably get a bit more in the summer. So.
I suppose if anything, having the shop gives you this room to work. And
I mean, we're never just sort of sitting in the shop waiting for people to come in, because our studio is right here, so we'll just be here sewing away, and then if someone comes in, we can go through. So.
Sure. The other thing I was going to ask about in terms of the shop is just about the name and like the sustainable element. I know it's a thing that you talk about a little bit on the website.
The name was Jimmy's idea, because he's brilliant with names. I'm rubbish.
I thought it sounded like Red or Dead, which was like, back when I was at college in the late 80s, Red or Dead were the big designers, and I thought Dick Rich sounded a bit like that, and it was like a kind of 40s thing.
It has like the vintagey thing,
yeah.
And also the sort of make, do and mend kind of aspect of getting the most out of your resources.
For anyone who doesn't know, I mean, do you want to just explain the origin of what Dig for Victory was initially?
So it's a World War II slogan, encouraging people to grow vegetables in their gardens or allotments.
Yeah, a bit of both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And because we use recycle, so the great thing about vintage fabric, I mean, most of the reason why I love it is just because it's really beautiful. You get much more interesting stuff. But the other good thing about it is that it's a lot of the time it's completely recycled, because it'd be curtains or breath beds, or else it'll be stuff that's just been kind of dead stock that never got sold at the time, and was like a lot of the stuff that I'm using at the moment comes from this big warehouse in Brick Lane that's been boarded up for 50 years because a company I think went bust in the early 1960s,
mm-hmm.
and nothing ever happened to the building. And now the building's been being sold, and a guy that I know is clearing it out.
Right.
And so he says that he goes in there, and it's all like thick with dust. And some of the fabric, you touch it, and it just crumbles away. And then some of it has been wrapped in brown paper, and it's perfectly preserved and just been lying there under all this dust for like 50 years. And so I feel much more happy using that than buying all. I mean, I do sometimes buy new fabrics, just because there are some things that you can't find vintage, but
sometimes if someone wants
something very particular, like a particular colour
or 9 bridesmaids dresses or something, and you just don't have that.
But as much as I can, I do like using the.
Do you think that's part of the appeal? Obviously it's in stark contrast to kind of like disposable high street fashion.
I think people like that aspect of it, and the aspect of it being made you know, they can actually see where it's made. And I think that's one of the reasons that people don't mind paying a little bit more, because they can actually, you know, they can see, like, our workshop here that we're making it.
I think, where are we up to? I think we're at about time-ish. Is there anything you want to plug?
I don't think.
Would you want to just let people know where they can get stuff? Where they can find you? Just, you know, the websites and for the band and for the shop.
Cool. So the website for the shop is digforvictoryclothing.com.
Yeah.
And on the website you can see all the ready-made dresses, but you can also actually design your own dress on it, because we've got the fabrics all photographed, and then it's set up so you can choose like your shape of neckline and your shape of skirt, mm-hmm. and your shape of sleeves, and have a dress custom made and send your measurements.
And how about music stuff? Where can people catch up with all that?
Mostly on Facebook at the moment. We've recorded an album worth of material, which is coming out in October, I believe. And we worked with a little record label from Manchester called Cherry Aid, and everything's all set up to go as soon as the distributors get their fingers out. And in October, we'll have a new album. That should be good. Lots of trumpet on it. It's going to be called Je viens de chercher mes bonbons. I have come to take back my bonbons, which is a Jacques Brel song. Yeah, which isn't on the album, but yeah.
Lovely. Well, thanks very much.
Yeah, cheers, thank you.
No worries, thank you. I don't want to see you up ever in your smartphone. No, no, no. And I don't want to know what car you drive or how much you earn. Oh, no. I just want to see your biggest. Show me. I just wanna see your biggest smile.